which is how I want you, and help you to be a warrior, which is what you want. She put her hand against his cheek. Da bo chi goilam, ba da van dod, and da goth lidi. And I you, he said. Without looking at her again, he turned to Balios and swung himself up into the saddle. She stepped back as she urged the horse toward the stable doors, and bending his head against the wind, galloped out into the night. Out of dreams of blood and metal monsters, Tessa woke with a start and a gasp. She lay crouched like a child on the bench seat of a large carriage whose windows were entirely covered with thick velvet curtains. The seat was hard and uncomfortable, with springs reaching to poke her sides through the material of her dress, which itself was torn and stained. Her hair had come down and hung in lank handfuls around her face. Across from her, huddled in the opposite corner of the carriage, sat a still figure, entirely covered in a thick black fur travelling cloak, its hood pulled down low. There was no one else in the carriage. Tessa struggled upright, fighting a bout of dizziness and nausea. She put her hands on her stomach and tried to breathe deeply, though the fetid air inside the carriage did little to calm her stomach. She put her hands against her chest, feeling the sweat trickle down the bodice of her dress.
"Not going to be sick, are you?" said a rusty voice. "Chloroform does have that side effect sometimes."
The hooded face creaked toward her, and Tessa saw the face of Mrs. Black. She had been too shocked on the steps of the Institute to make a real study of the visage of her erstwhile captor, but now that she could see it up close, she shuddered. The skin had a greenish tint, the eyes were veined in black, and the lips sagged, showing a view of grey tongue. "Where are you taking me?" Tessa demanded. It was always the first thing heroines in gothic novels asked when they were kidnapped, and it had always annoyed her, but she realized now it actually made good sense. In this sort of situation, the first thing you wanted to know was where you were going.
"To Mortmain," said Mrs. Black. "And that's all the information you'll get out of me, girl. I've been given strict instructions."
It was nothing Tessa hadn't expected, but it tightened her chest and shortened her breath anyway. On impulse, she leaned away from Mrs. Black and pulled back the curtain across her window. Outside it was dark, with a half-hidden moon. The countryside was hilly and angular, without spots of light to be seen that might have meant habitation. Black heaps of rock dotted the land. Tessa reached as subtly as she could for the handle of the door and tried it. It was locked.
"Do not bother," said the Dark Sister. "You cannot unlock the door, and if you were to flee, I would catch you. I'm much faster now than you recall."
"Is that how you disappeared on the steps?" Tessa demanded. "Back at the Institute?" Mrs. Black gave a superior smile.
"Disappeared to your eyes. I only moved swiftly away, and then back again. Mortmain has given me that gift."
"Is that why you're doing this?" Tessa spat. "Gratitude for Mortmain? He didn't think much of you. He sent Jem and Will to kill you when he thought you were going to get in his way." The moment she said Jem and Will's names, she blanched with memory. She'd been carried off while the Shadow Hunters had been fighting desperately for their lives on the Institute steps. Had they held out against the automatons? Had any of them been injured? Or, God forbid, killed? But surely she would know, be able to feel it if anything like that had happened to Jem or to Will. She was so conscious of them both as pieces of her heart.
"No," said Mrs. Black, "to answer the question in your eyes, you wouldn't know if either of them were dead. Those pretty Shadow Hunter boys you like so much. So people always imagine, but unless there exists a magical tie like the Parabatai bond, it is but a fanciful imagining. When I left, they were fighting for their lives," she grinned, and her teeth sparked metallic in the dimness. "If I did not have orders from Mortmain to bring you to him unharmed, I would have left you there to be cut into strips."
"Why does he want you to bring me to him unharmed?"
"You and your questions. I'd nearly forgotten how annoying it was. There is some information he wants that only you can provide him. And he still wants to marry you. the more fool him. Let you devil him all his life for all I mind. I want what I want from him, and then I will be gone.
There is nothing I could possibly know that would interest Mortmain, Mrs. Black snorted.
You are so young and stupid. You are not human, Miss Grey, and there is very little you understand about what you can do. We might have taught you more, but you are recalcitrant. You will find Mortmain a less lenient instructor.
Lenient? Tessa snapped. You beat me bloody.
There are worse things than physical pain, Miss Grey. Mortmain has little mercy.
Exactly. Tessa leaned forward, her clockwork angel beating double time under the bodice of her dress. Why do you do what he asks you? You know you can't trust him. You know he would happily destroy you.
I need what he can give me, Mrs. Black said, and I will do what I must to obtain it.
And what is that? Tessa demanded. She heard Mrs. Black laugh, and her dark sister slipped back her hood and unfastened the collar of her cloak. Tessa had read in history books about heads on spikes over London Bridge, but she had never imagined how horrific it would actually look. Obviously, whatever decay Mrs. Black had suffered after her head had been severed had not been reversed, so ragged grey skin hung down around the spike of metal that impaled her skull. She had no body, only a smooth column of metal from which two stick-like jointed arms protruded. The grey kid gloves that covered whatever sort of hands jutted from the ends of the arms added the last macabre touch. Tessa screamed. Chapter 12. Ghosts on the Road.
Oh, ever beauteous, ever friendly, tell, is it in heaven a crime to love too well? To bear too tender, or too firm a heart? To act a lover's, or a Roman's part? Is there no bright reversion in the sky for those who greatly think or bravely die? Alexander Pope, Elegy to the Memory of an Unfortunate Lady.
Will stood upon the crest of a low hill, his hands jammed into his pockets, gazing out impatiently over the placid countryside of Bedfordshire. He had ridden with all the speed he and Balliol could muster out of London toward the Great North Road. Leaving so near to dawn had meant the streets had been fairly clear, as he pounded through Islington, Holloway and Highgate. He had passed a few costermonger carts and a pedestrian or two, but otherwise there had been nothing much to hold him up, and as Balliol did not tire as quickly as an ordinary horse, Will had soon been out of Barnet, and able to gallop through South Mimms and London Colney. Will loved to gallop, flat to the horse's back with the wind in his hair and Balliol's hooves eating up the road underneath him. Now that he was gone from London, he felt both a tearing pain and a strange freedom. It was odd to feel both at once, but he could not help it. Near Colney there were ponds. He'd stopped to water Balliol there before journeying on. Now, almost 30 miles north of London, he could not help recalling coming through this way on his way to the Institute years ago. He'd brought one of his father's horses part of the way from Wales, but had sold it in Staffordshire when he'd realised he did not have money for the toll roads. He knew now that he had gotten a very bad price, and it had been a struggle to say goodbye to Hengroen, the horse he had grown up riding, and even more of a struggle to trudge the remaining miles to London on foot. By the time he reached the Institute, his feet had been bleeding, and his hands too, where he had fallen on the road and scraped them. He looked down at his hands now, where the memory of those hands laid over them. Thin hands with long fingers. All the Herondales had them. Jem had always said it was a shame he didn't have a bit of musical talent, as his hands were made to span a piano. The thought of Jem was like the stab of a needle. Will pushed the memory away and turned back to Balliol. He had stopped here, not just to water the horse, but to feed him with a handful of oats, good for speed and endurance, and let him rest. He had often heard of cavalry riding their horses until they died, but desperate as he was to get to Tessa, he could not imagine doing something so cruel. There was a deal of traffic, carts on the road, dray horses with brewery wagons, dairy vans, even the odd horse-drawn omnibus. Really? Did all these people have to be out and about in the middle of a Wednesday, clustering up the roads? At least there were no highwaymen. Railways, toll roads, and proper police had put an end to highway robbers decades ago. Will would have hated to have to waste time killing anybody. He had skirted St. Albans, not bothering to stop for lunch in his hurry to catch up to Watling Street, the ancient Roman road that had now split at Wroxeter, with one half crossing up to Scotland and the other cutting through England to the port of Holyhead in Wales. There were ghosts on the road. Will caught whispers of old Anglo-Saxon on the winds, calling the road Wallachinstraat, and speaking of the last stand of the troops of Boadicea, who had been defeated by the Romans along this road so many years ago. Now, with his hands in his pockets, staring out over the countryside, it was 3 o'clock and the sky was beginning to darken, which meant that Will would soon have to consider the nightfall, and finding an inn to stop at, rest his horse and sleep. He could not help remembering when he had told Tessa that Boadicea proved that women could be warriors too. He had not told her then that he had read her letters, that he already loved the warrior soul in her, hidden behind those quiet grey eyes. He remembered a dream he had, blue skies and Tessa sitting down beside him on a green hill. "You will always come first in my heart." A fierce rage blossomed in his soul. How dare Mortmain touch her? She was one of them. She did not belong to Will. She was too much herself to belong to anyone, even Jem. But she belonged with them, and silently he cursed the consul for not seeing it. He would find her. He would find her and bring her back home, even if she never loved him. It would be all right. He would have done this for her, for himself. He spun back toward Balios, who looked at him balefully. Will swung himself up into the saddle. "Come on, old boy," he said. "Sun's going down, and we ought to make Hawcliffe by nightfall, for it looks liable to rain." He dug his heels into the horse's sides, and Balios, as if he had understood his rider's words, took off like a shot. "He's gone off to Wales alone?" Charlotte demanded. "How could you have let him do something so stupid?" Magnus shrugged. "It's not my responsibility now, nor will it ever be my responsibility to manage wayward shadow hunters. In fact, I'm not sure why I am to blame. I spent the night in the library waiting for Will to come and talk to me, which he never did. Eventually I fell asleep in the rabies and lycanthropy section. Woolsey bites on occasion, and I'm concerned." No one really responded to this information, although Charlotte looked more upset than ever. It had been a quiet breakfast as it was, with quite a few of them missing from the table. Will's absence had not been surprising. They'd assumed Will was at his parapetai's side. So it had not been until Cyril had burst in, breathless and agitated, to report that Balios was gone from his stall, that the alarm had been raised. A search at the Institute turned up Magnus Bane, asleep in a corner of the library. Charlotte had shaken him awake. On being asked where he thought Will might be, Magnus had replied quite candidly that he expected that Will had already left for Wales with the object of discovering Tessa's whereabouts and bringing her back to the Institute, whether by stealth or main force. This information, much to his surprise, had thrown Charlotte into a panic, and she had convened a meeting in the library, at which all the shadow hunters at the Institute, save Jem, were commanded to appear. Even Gideon, who had arrived limping and leaning heavily on a stick. "Does anyone know when Will left?" Charlotte demanded, standing at the head of a long table around which the rest of them were seated. Cecily, her hands folded demurely before her, suddenly became very interested in the pattern of the carpet. "That is a very fine gem you're wearing, Cecily," Charlotte noted, narrowing her eyes at the ruby about the girl's throat. "I don't recall you having that necklace yesterday. In fact, I recall Will wearing it. When did he give it to you?" Cecily crossed her arms over her chest. "I will say nothing. Will's decisions are his own, and we already tried to explain to the consul what needed to be done. Since the cave will not help, Will took matters into his own hands. I don't know why you're expecting anything different." "I did not think he would leave Jem," said Charlotte, and then she looked shocked that she had said it.
I cannot even imagine how we will tell him when he wakes.
Jem knows, Cecily began indignantly, but she was interrupted to her surprise by Gabriel.
Of course he knows, he said. Will is only doing his duty as a parabatai. He is doing what Jem would be doing if he could. He has gone in Jem's place. It is only what a parabatai should do.
You are defending Will, Gideon said, after the way you always treated him. After telling Jem on dozens of occasions that he had dismal taste in parabatai.
Will may be a reprehensible person, but at least this demonstrates that he is not a reprehensible shadow hunter, said Gabriel. And then, catching Cecily's look, he added,
he might not be that reprehensible as a person either, in entirety.
A very magnanimous statement, Gideon, said Magnus.
I'm Gabriel, Magnus waved a hand.
All lightwoods look the same to me.
Ahem, Gideon interrupted, before Gabriel could pick up something and throw it at Magnus. Regardless of Will's personal qualities and failings or anyone else's inability to tell one lightwood from another, the question remains the same. Do we go after Will?
If Will wanted help, he wouldn't have ridden off in the middle of the night without telling anyone, said Cecily.
Yes, said Gideon. Because Will is well known for his careful, thought-out, and prudent decision-making.
He did steal our fastest horse, Henry pointed out. That bespeaks forethought. Of a sort.
We cannot allow Will to ride off to battle Mortmain alone. He'll be slaughtered, Gideon said.
If he really did leave in the midst of the night, we might yet be able to overtake him on the road.
Fastest horse,
reminded Henry. And Magnus snorted under his breath.
Actually, it is not an inevitable slaughter, Gabriel said. We could all ride off after Will, certainly, but the fact is that such a force sent against the Magister would be more noticeable than any one boy on horseback. Will's best hope is remaining undetected. After all, he is not riding off to war. He is going to save Tessa. Stealth and secrecy best behoove such a mission.
Charlotte slammed her hand down on the table with such force that the sound reverberated through the room.
All of you be silent,
she said, in such a commanding tone that even Magnus looked alarmed.
Gabriel, Gideon, you're both correct. It is better for Will if we do not follow him, and we cannot allow one of our own to perish. It is also true that the Magister is beyond our reach. The Council will meet to decide on that matter.
There is nothing we can do about that now.
Therefore we must bend all our energies to saving Jem. He is dying, but not dead. Part of Will's strength relies on him, and he is one of our own. He has finally given us permission to seek a cure for him, and therefore we must do that.
But,
Gabriel began,
silence, Charlotte said. I am the head of the Institute. You will remember who saved you from your father and show me respect.
That's putting Gideon in his place, all right, Magnus said with satisfaction.
Charlotte turned on him with blazing eyes.
And you too, Warlock. Will may have summoned you here, but you remain on my sufferance. It is my understanding that, as you told me this morning, you promised Will that you would do all you could to help find a cure for Jem while Will was gone. You will be telling Gabriel and Cecily where the shop is from which they might procure the ingredients you need. Gideon, since you are wounded, you will remain in the library and seek out whatever books Magnus requires. If you need help, myself or Sophie will provide it. Henry, perhaps Magnus can use your crypt as a laboratory, unless there is a project you are engaged in that would forbid it.
She looked at Henry with her eyebrows raised.
There is,
Henry said a bit hesitantly.
But it might also be turned to helping Jem, and I would welcome Mr. Bane's assistance. In return, he can certainly make use of any of my scientific implements.
Magnus looked at him curiously.
What are you working on, exactly?
Well, you know we do not perform magic, Mr. Bane, said Henry, looking delighted that anyone was taking an interest in his experiments. But I am at work on a device a bit like the scientific version of a transportation spell. It would open a doorway into any place you wanted.
Including, perhaps, a storeroom full of Yin Fen in China, Magnus said with his eyes aglint. That sounds very interesting. Very interesting indeed. No, it doesn't, muttered Gabriel. Charlotte fixed him with a dagger gaze.
Mr. Lightwood, enough. I believe you have all been assigned your tasks. Go forth and perform them. I wish to hear no more from any of you until you bring me back a report of some progress made. I will be with Jem. And with that, she swept from the room.
What a very satisfying response, said Mrs. Black.
Tessa glared. She was crouched in the corner of the carriage, as far as she could get from the horrible sight of the creature that had once been Mrs. Black. She had screamed at the first sight of her, and hastily clapped a hand over her mouth, but it was too late. Mrs. Black had been plainly delighted by her terrified reaction.
You were beheaded, Tessa said. How is it that you live like that?
Magic, said Mrs. Black. It was your brother who suggested to Mortmain that in my current form I could be of use to him. It was your brother who spilled the blood that made my continued existence possible. Lives for my life.
She grinned horribly, and Tessa thought of her brother dying in her arms.
You don't know everything I've done, Tessie.
She swallowed back bile. After her brother was dead, she had tried to change into him, to glean any information about Mortmain she could from his memories. But there had only been a grey swirl of anger and bitterness and ambition. She had found nothing solid within them. A fresh surge of hate welled in her for Mortmain, who had found her brother's weaknesses and exploited them. Mortmain, who held Jem's Yin Fen in a cruel attempt to make Shadowhunters dance to his tune. Even Mrs. Black, in a way, was a prisoner of his manipulations.
You are doing Mortmain's bidding because you think he will give you a body, Tessa said.
Not that thing you have, but some sort of real human body.
Human, Mrs. Black snorted. I expect better than human, but better than this as well. Something that will allow me to pass undetected among mundanes and practice my craft again. As for the Magister, I know he will have the power to do it because of you. He will soon be all-powerful, and you will help him get there.
You are a fool to trust him to reward you.
Mrs. Black's grey lips wobbled with mirth.
Oh, but he will. He has sworn it, and I have done everything I promised. Here I am delivering his perfect bride, trained by me, by Azazel. I remember when you stepped off the boat from America. You seemed so purely mortal, so entirely useless. I despaired of ever training you to be any sort of use at all. But with enough brutality, anything can be shaped. You will serve nicely now.
Not all that is mortal is useless. A snort.
You say that because of your association with the Nephilim. You have been with them rather than your own kind for far too long.
What kind? I have no kind. Jessamine said my mother was a Shadowhunter.
She was a Shadowhunter, said Mrs. Black. But your father was not.
Tess's heart skipped a beat.
He was a demon?
He was no angel, Mrs. Black smirked. The Magister will explain it all to you in time. What you are, and why you live, and what you were created for.
She settled back with a creak of automated joint.
I have to say that I was almost impressed when you ran off with that Shadowhunter boy, you know. It showed you had spirit. In fact, it turned out to the Magister's benefit that you have spent so much time with the Nephilim. You are acquainted with Downworld now, and you have shown yourself equal to it. You have been forced to use your gift in arduous circumstances. Tests that I might have created for you would not have been as challenging, and would not have yielded the same learning and confidence. I can see the difference in you. You will make a fine bride for the Magister.
Tessa made a sound of disbelief.
Why? I am being forced to marry him. What difference does it make if I have spirit or learning? What could he possibly care?
Oh, you are to be more than his bride, Miss Grey. You are to be the ruin of the Nephilim. That is why you were created. And the more knowledge of them you have, the more your sympathies lie with them, the more effective a weapon you will be to raise them to the ground.
Tessa felt as if the air had been knocked out of her.
I don't care what Mormaine does. I will not cooperate in harming the Shadow Hunters. I would die or be tortured first.
It does not matter what you want. You will find that there is no resistance you could mount against his will that would matter. Besides, there is nothing you need to do to destroy the Nephilim, other than to be what you are, and be married to Mortmain, which requires no action on your part.
I'm engaged to someone else, spat Tessa. James Carstairs.
Oh dear, said Mrs. Black. I'm afraid the Magister's claim supersedes his. Besides, James Carstairs will be dead by Tuesday.
Mortmain has bought up all the infed in England and blocked any new shipments.
Perhaps you should have thought of this sort of thing before you fell in love with an addict. Although I did think it would be the blue-eyed one, she mused. Don't girls usually fall in love with their rescuers?
Tessa felt the cloak of the surreal begin to descend. She could not believe that she was here, trapped in this carriage with Mrs. Black, and that the warlock woman seemed content to discuss Tessa's romantic tribulations. She turned toward the window. The moon was up, and she could see that they were riding along a narrow road. There were shadows about the carriage, and below, a rocky ravine fell away into darkness. There are all sorts of ways of being rescued.
Well, said Mrs. Black with a glint of teeth as she smiled, you can be assured that no one will be coming to rescue you now.
You are to be the ruin of the Nephilim.
Then I'll have to rescue myself, Tessa said. Mrs. Black's eyebrows drew together in puzzlement as she turned her head toward Tessa with a whir and a click. But Tessa was already gathering herself, gathering all her energy in her legs and body in the way that she had been taught, so that when she launched herself across the carriage at the door, it was with all the force she possessed. She heard the lock on the door break and Mrs. Black scream a high whine of rage. A metal arm raked Tessa's back, seizing the collar of her dress, which tore away, and Tessa was falling, slamming down onto the rocks by the side of the road, falling and sliding and tumbling into the ravine as the carriage hurtled away down the road, Mrs. Black screaming at the driver to stop. Wind rushed into Tessa's ears as she fell, her arms and hands windmilling wildly against the empty space all around her, and any hopes that the ravine was shallow or that the fall would be survivable were gone. As she fell, she glimpsed a narrow stream glinting far below her, twisting among jagged rocks, and she knew she would break against the ground like fragile china when she struck. She closed her eyes and willed that the end be quick.
Will stood at the top of a high green hill and looked out over the sea. The sky and sea were both so intensely blue, they seemed to merge one into the other, so that there was no fixed point upon the horizon. Gulls and terns wheeled and shrieked above him, and the salt wind blew through his hair. It was as warm as summer, and his jacket lay discarded on the grass. He was in shirt sleeves and braces, and his hands were brown and tanned by the sun.
Will.
He turned at the familiar voice and saw Tessa coming up the hill toward him. There was a small path cut along the side of the hill, lined with unfamiliar white flowers, and Tessa looked like a flower herself, in a white dress, like the one she had worn to the ball the night he had kissed her on Benedict Lightwood's balcony. Her long brown hair blew in the wind. She had taken off her bonnet and held it in one hand, waving it at him, and smiling as if she were glad to see him. More than glad. As if seeing him were all the joy of her heart. His own heart leaped up at the sight of her. Tess, he called, and he reached out a hand as if he could pull her toward him, but she was still such a distance away. She seemed both very near and very far suddenly and at the same time. He could see every detail of her pretty, upturned face, but could not touch her. And so he stood, waiting and desiring, and his heart beat like wings in his chest. At last she was there, close enough that he could see where the grass and flowers bent beneath the tread of her shoes. He reached out for her, and she for him. Their hands closed on each other's, and for a moment they stood smiling, and her fingers were warm in his. "I've been waiting for you," Will said, and she looked up at him with a smile that vanished from her face as her feet slipped, and she tilted toward the edge of the cliff. Her hands tore out of his, and suddenly he was reaching out for air as she fell away from him, silently fell, a white blur against the blue horizon. Will sat bolt upright in bed, his heart slamming against his ribs. His room at the White Horse was half full of moonlight, which clearly outlined the unfamiliar shapes of the furniture. The washstand and side table with its unread copy of Fordyce's Sermons to Young Women, the overstuffed chair by the fireplace in which the flames had burned down to embers. The sheets of his bed were cold, but he was sweating. He swung his legs over the side and walked to the window. There was a stiff bunch of arranged dry flowers in a vase on the sill. He pushed them out of the way and unlatched the pane with aching fingers. His whole body hurt. He had never ridden so far or so hard in his life before, and he was weary and saddle sore. He would need Aratzes before he started out on the road again tomorrow. The window opened outward, and cold air blew against his face and hair, cooling his skin. There was an ache inside him, under his ribs, that had nothing to do with riding. Whether it was the separation from Jem, or his anxiety over Tessa, he could not say. He kept seeing her falling away from him, their hands unclasping. He had never been one to believe in the prophetic meaning of dreams, and yet he could not undo the tight, cold knot inside his stomach, or regulate his harsh breathing. In the dark pane of the window, he could see the reflection of his face. He touched the window lightly, his fingertips leaving marks in the condensation on the glass. He wondered what he would say to Tessa when he found her. How could he tell her why it was that he was the one who had come after her, and not Jem? If there was grace in the world, perhaps at least they could grieve together. If she never truly believed he loved her, if she never returned his affection, at least mercy might grant that they be able to share their sadness. Nearly unable to bear the thought of how much he needed her quiet strength, he closed his eyes and leaned his forehead against the cold glass. As they made their way through the East End's winding lanes from Limehouse Station toward Gill Street, Gabriel could not help but be aware of Cecily by his side. They were glamoured, which was useful, as her appearance in this poorer part of London would otherwise doubtless have excited comment, and perhaps resulted in their being hauled into a broker's shop willy-nilly to look at the goods on offer. As it was, Cecily was intensely curious, and paused often to gaze into shop windows, not just milliners and bonnet makers, but shops selling everything from boot polish and books to toys and tin soldiers. Gabriel had to remind himself that she came from the countryside and had probably never seen a thriving market town, much less anything like London. He wished he could take her somewhere befitting a lady of her station, the shops of Bellington Arcade or Piccadilly, not these dark, close streets. He did not know what he had expected from Will Herondale's sister. That she would be just as unpleasant as Will? That she would not look so disconcertingly like him and yet at the same time be extraordinarily pretty? He had rarely looked at Will's face without wanting to hit it, but Cecily's face was endlessly fascinating. He found himself wanting to write poetry about how her blue eyes were like starlight and her hair like night, because night and starlight rhymed. But he had a feeling the poem wouldn't turn out that well, and Tatiana had rather frightened him off poetry as it was. Besides, there were things he couldn't put in poetry anyway, like the way that when a certain girl curved her mouth in a certain way, he wanted very much to lean forward and... "Mr. Lightwood," Cecily said in an impatient tone, that indicated that this was not the first time she had tried to get Gabriel's attention. "I do believe we passed the shop already." Gabriel cursed under his breath and turned back. They had indeed passed the number Magnus had given them. They retraced their steps until they found themselves standing before a dark, ill-favored shop with clouded windows. Through the murky glass, he was able to see shelves on which sat a variety of peculiar items. Jars in which dead serpents floated, their eyes white and open, dolls whose heads had been removed and replaced with small gold birdcages, and stacked bracelets made of human teeth.
"Oh dear," said Cecily, "how decidedly unpleasant."
"Do you not wish to enter?" Gabriel turned to her.
"I could go instead. And leave me standing about on a cold pavement. How ungentlemanly."
"Certainly not."
She reached for the knob and pushed the door open, setting a small bell somewhere in the shop tinkling.
"After me, please, Mr. Lightwood."
Gabriel went blinking after her into the dim light of the shop. The inside was no more welcoming than the exterior. Long rows of dusty shelves led back toward a shadowy counter. The windows seemed to be smeared with some dark unguent, blocking out much of the sunlight. The shelves themselves were a cluttered mess. Brass bells with handles shaped like bones, fat candles whose wax was stuffed with insects and flowers. A lovely golden crown of such peculiar shape and diameter that it could never have fit a human head. There were shelves of knives and copper and stone bowls whose basins were marked with peculiar brownish stains. There were stacks of gloves of all sizes, some with more than 5 fingers on each hand. An entire defleshed human skeleton hung from a thin cord toward the front of the shop, twisting in the air, for there was no breeze. Gabriel looked quickly towards Cecily to see if she had quailed, but she had not. She looked irritated, if anything.
"Someone really ought to dust in here," she announced, and swept back towards the back of the shop, the small flowers on her hat bouncing.
Gabriel shook his head. He caught up to Cecily just as she brought her gloved hand down on the brass bell on the counter, setting it to an impatient ringing.
"Hello?" she called. "Is anyone here?"
"Directly in front of you, miss," said an irritable voice,
downward and to the left. Both Cecily and Gabriel leaned over the counter. Just below the edge of it was the top of the head of a small man. No, not quite a man, thought Gabriel, as the glamour peeled away. A satyr. He wore a waistcoat and trousers, though no shirt, and had the cloven feet and neatly curling horns of a goat. He also had a trimmed beard, a pointed jaw, and the rectangular pupilled yellow eyes of a goat, half hidden behind spectacles.
"Gracious," said Cecily. "You must be Mr. Sarlos."
"Nephilim," observed the shop owner gloomily. "I detest Nephilim."
"Hm," said Cecily. "Charmed, I'm sure."
Gabriel felt it was about time to intervene.
"How did you know that we were shadow hunters?" he snapped.
Sallows raised his eyebrows.
"Your marks, sir, are clearly visible on your hands and throat," he said, as if talking to a child. "And as for the girl, she looks just like her brother."
"How would you know my brother?" Cecily demanded, her voice rising.
"We don't get many of your kind in here," said Sallows. "It's notable when we do. Your brother Will was in and out quite a bit 2 months ago, running errands for that warlock, Magnus Bane. He was down the Crossing Bones too, bothering old Maul. Will Herondale's well known in Danweald, though he mostly keeps himself out of trouble."
"That is astonishing news," said Gabriel. Cecily gave Gabriel a dark look.
"We're here on the authority of Charlotte Branwell," she said, "head of the London Institute."
The satyr waved a hand.
"I don't care much for your shadow hunter hierarchies, you know. None of the fair folk do. Just tell me what you want and I'll give you a fair price for it."
Gabriel unrolled the paper Magnus had given him.
"Thieves vinegar, bathead root, belladonna, angelica, damiana leaf, powdered mermaid scales, and 6 nails from a virgin's coffin."
"Well, we don't get much call for that sort of thing around here. I'll have a look in the back."
"Well, if you don't get much call for this sort of thing, what do you get called for?" asked Gabriel, losing his patience. "You're hardly a florist shop."
"Mr. Lightwood," chided Cecily under her breath.
But not quite enough under her breath, for Sallows heard her, and his spectacles bounced on his nose.
"Mr. Lightwood," he said. "You're Benedict Lightwood's son."
Gabriel could feel the blood heating his cheeks. He had spoken to almost no one about his father since Benedict's death, if one could even count that thing that died in the Italian garden as his father,
Once it had been he and his family against the world, the Lightwoods above all else. But now... now there was shame in the name of Lightwood, as much as there had ever been pride, and Gabriel did not know how to speak of it. "Yes," he said finally. "I am Benedict Lightwood's son."
"Wonderful. I have some of your father's orders here. I was beginning to wonder if you could ever come and pick them up."
The satyr bustled into the back, and Gabriel busied himself studying the wall. There were landscape sketches hung on it and maps on it, but as he looked more closely, not sketches or maps of any place he knew. There was Idris, of course, with Russell and Forest and Alicante on its hill, but another map showed continents he had never seen before. And what was the Silver Sea, the Thorn Mountains? What sort of country had a purple sky?
"Gabriel," said Cecily beside him in a low voice.
It was the first time she had used his Christian name in addressing him, and he began to turn toward her, just as Sallows emerged from the back of the shop. In one hand he carried a tied parcel, which he handed over to Gabriel. It was quite lumpy, clearly the bottles of Magnus's ingredients. In the other hand, Sallows clutched a stack of papers which he set down on the counter.
"Your father's order," he said with a smirk.
Gabriel lowered his eyes to the papers, and his jaw dropped in horror.
"Gracious," Cecily said. "Surely that is impossible."
The satyr craned up to see what she was looking at.
"Well, not with one person, but with a Vetus demon and a goat most likely," he turned to Gabriel. "Now, have you got the money for these or not? Your father is behind on his payments and he can't buy on tit forever. What's it going to be, Lightwood?"
"Has Charlotte ever asked you if you wanted to be a shadow hunter?" Gideon asked.
Halfway down the ladder with a book in her hand, Sophie froze. Gideon was seated at one of the long library tables near a bay window that looked out over the courtyard. Books and papers were spread out before him, and he and Sophie had passed several pleasant hours searching through them for lists and histories of spells, details about Yin Fen, and specifics of herb lore. Though Gideon's leg was rapidly healing, it was propped up on two chairs in front of him, and Sophie had cheerfully offered to do all the climbing up and down ladders to reach the highest books. She was holding one now called the Pseudomonarchia Daemonum, which had a rather slimy feeling cover, and which she was eager to put down, though Gideon's question had startled her enough to rest her mid-descent.
"What do you mean?"
she said, resuming her climb down the ladder. "Why would Charlotte have asked me something like that?" Gideon looked pale, or it might simply have been the cast of the witchlight on his face.
"Miss Collins," he said, "you are one of the best fighters I have ever trained, Nephilim included. That is why I ask. Seems a shame to waste such talent, though perhaps it is not something you would want."
Sophie set the book down on the table and sat down opposite Gideon. She knew she should hesitate, seemed to think the question over, but the answer was on her lips before she could stop it.
"To be a shadow hunter is all I ever wanted."
He leaned forward, and the witchlight shone up into his eyes, washing out their colour.
"You are not worried about the danger?"
"The older one is when one ascends, the riskier the process. I have heard them speaking about lowering the age of agreement to ascension to 14, or even 12.
Sophie shook her head.
"I have never feared the risk. I would take it gladly. It's only that I fear that if I applied for it, Mrs. Bramwell would think I'm ungrateful for all that she's done for me. She saved my life and raised me up. She gave me safety and a home. I would not repay her for all that by abandoning her service."
"No," Gideon shook his head. "Sophie, Miss Collins, you are a free servant in a shadow hunter home. You have the sight. You know all there is to know of Downworlders and the Nephilim already. You are the perfect candidate for ascension." He placed his hand atop the demonology book. "I am a voice on the council. I could speak for you."
"I can't," Sophie said in a soft thread of a voice. Didn't he understand what he was offering her, the temptation?
"And certainly not now."
"No, not now, of course, with James so ill," Gideon said hurriedly. "But in the future, perhaps." His eyes searched her face,
and she felt a blush begin to creep up from her collar. The most obvious and common way for a mundane to ascend to Shadowhunter status was through marriage to a Shadowhunter. She wondered what it meant that he seemed very determined not to mention that. But when I asked you, you spoke so strongly. You said that being a Shadowhunter was all you ever wanted. Why is that? It can be a brutal life.
All life could be brutal, said Sophie.
My life before I came to the Institute was hardly sweet.
I suppose in part I wish to be a Shadowhunter, so that if another man ever comes at me with a knife in his hand, as my former employer did, I can kill him where he stands.
She touched her cheek as she spoke, an unconscious gesture she could not help, feeling the rigid scar tissue under her fingertips. She saw Gideon's expression, shock mixed with discomfort, and dropped her hand.
I did not know that was how you had been scarred, he said.
She looked away.
Now you'll say it's not so ugly, or that you do not even see it, or something like that.
I see it, Gideon said in a low voice. I'm not blind, and we are a people of many scars. I see it, but it is not ugly. It is just another beautiful part of the most beautiful girl I have ever seen. Now Sophie did blush. She could feel her cheeks burn, and as Gideon leaned forward across the table, his eyes an intense, storm-washed green, she took a deep breath of resolution. He was not like her former employer. He was Gideon. She would not push him away this time. The door of the library flew open. Charlotte stood on the threshold looking exhausted. There were damp splotches on her pale blue dress and her eyes were shadowed. Sophie sprang to her feet instantly.
Mrs. Branwell!
Oh, Sophie, Charlotte sighed.
I was hoping you could sit with Jem for a bit.
He hasn't woken up yet. But Bridget needs to make supper, and I think her dreadful singing is giving him nightmares in his sleep.
Of course.
Sophie hurried to the door, not looking at Gideon as she did so. Although as the door closed behind her, she was fairly sure that she heard him swearing softly and with great frustration in Spanish.
You know, Cecily said, you really didn't have to throw that man through the window.
He wasn't a man. Gabriel said, scowling down at the heap of objects in his arms.
He had taken the parcel of Magnus's ingredients that Sallows had made up for them, and a few more useful-looking objects off the shelves besides. He had pointedly left all the papers his father had ordered on the counter where Sallows had put them, after Gabriel had tossed the satyr through one of the grimed-up windows. It had been very satisfying, with shattered glass everywhere. The force of it had even dislodged the hanging skeleton, which had come apart in a clatter of messy bones.
He was an unseelie court fairy, one of the nasty ones.
Is that why you chased him down the street?
He had no business showing images like that to a lady, Gabriel muttered, though it had been admitted that the lady in question had hardly turned a hair, and seemed more annoyed with Gabriel for his reaction than impressed by his chivalry.
And I do think it was excessive to hurl him into the canal.
He'll float.
The corners of Cecily's mouth twitched.
It was very wrong.
You're laughing, Gabriel said in surprise.
I am not, Cecily raised her chin, turning her face away.
But not before Gabriel saw the grin that spread over her face. Gabriel was baffled. After her displayed disdain for him, her cheek and back talk, he had been quite sure that this latest outburst of his would prompt her to tell tales to Charlotte as soon as they returned to the Institute. But instead, she seemed amused. He shook his head as they turned into Garnet Street. He would never understand the Herondales.
"Hand over that vial there on the shelf, would you, Mr. Bain?" asked Henry.
Magnus did so. He was standing in the centre of Henry's laboratory, looking around at the gleaming shapes on tables around him.
"What are all these contraptions, if I might ask?"
Henry, who was wearing two pairs of goggles at the same time, one on his head and one over his eyes, looked both pleased and nervous to be asked. Magnus presumed the two pairs of goggles was a fit of absent-mindedness, but in case it was in pursuit of fashion, he decided not to ask. Henry picked up a square brass object with multiple buttons.
"Well, over here, this is a sensor. It senses when demons are near.
He moved toward Magnus, and the sensor made a loud, wailing noise.
Impressive,
Magnus exclaimed, pleased. He lifted a construction of fabric with a large dead bird perched atop it.
And what is this?
The lethal bonnet, Henry declared.
Ah, said Magnus.
In times of need, a lady can produce weapons from it with which to slay her enemies.
Well, no, Henry admitted. That does sound like a rather better idea. I do wish you had been on the spot when I had the notion. Unfortunately, this bonnet wraps around the head of one's enemy and suffocates them, provided they are wearing it at the time.
I imagine it will not be easy to persuade Mortmain into a bonnet, Magnus observed, though the color would be fetching on him.
Henry burst into laughter.
Very droll, Mr. Bane.
Please, call me Magnus.
I shall.
Henry tossed the bonnet over his shoulder and picked up a round glass jar of a sparkling substance.
This is a powder that, when applied to the air, causes ghosts to become visible, Henry said.
Magnus tilted the jar of shining grains up to the lamp admiringly, and when Henry beamed in an encouraging fashion, Magnus removed the cork.
Seems very fine to me, he said, and on a whim, he poured it upon his hand. It coated his brown skin, gloving one hand in shimmering luminescence.
And in addition to its practical uses, it would seem to work for more cosmetic purposes.
This powder would make my skin glimmer for eternity.
Henry frowned.
Not eternity, he said, and then he brightened. But I could make you up another batch whenever you please.
I could shine it well, Magnus grinned at Henry.
These are fascinating items, Mr. Bramwell. You think differently about the world than any other Nephilim I have ever encountered. I confess I thought your people somewhat lacking in imagination, though high in personal drama. But you have given me a completely different opinion. Surely the Shadow Hunter community must honor you, hold you in high esteem as a gentleman who has truly advanced their race.
No, Henry said sadly. Mostly, they wish that I would stop suggesting new inventions and cease setting fire to things.
But all invention comes with risk, cried Magnus. I have seen the transformation wrought on the world by the invention of the steam engine, and the proliferation of printed materials, the factories and mills which have changed the face of England. Mundanes have taken the world into their hands and made of it a marvelous thing. Warlocks, through the ages, have dreamed up and perfected different spells to make themselves a different world. Would the Shadow Hunters be the only ones to remain stagnant and changeless, and therefore doomed? How can they turn their noses up at the genius that you have displayed? It is like turning towards shadows and away from light.
Henry blushed a scarlet color. It was clear that no one had ever complimented his inventing before, except perhaps Charlotte.
You humble me, Mr. Bane.
Magnus, the warlock reminded him.
Now may I see your work upon this portal you were describing? The invention that transports a living being from one spot to another?
Of course.
Henry drew a heavy pile of notepaper from one corner of his cluttered table and pushed it towards Magnus. The warlock took it and flicked through the pages with interest. Each page was covered with crabbed, spidery handwriting and dozens of equations, blending mathematics and runes into a startling harmony. Magnus felt his heart beating faster as he flipped through the pages.
This was genius. Real genius. There was only one problem.
I see what you're trying to do, he said. And it is almost perfected, but...
Yes, almost.
Henry ran his hands through his gingery hair, upsetting his goggles.
The portal can be open, but there is no way to direct it, no way to know if we will step through it to your intended destination in this world, or into another world altogether, or even into hell. It is too risky and therefore useless.
You cannot do it with these runes, said Magnus. You need runes other than the ones you are using.
Henry shook his head. We can only use the runes from the Grey Book. Anything else is magic. Magic is not the way of the Nephilim. It is something we may not do.
Magnus looked at Henry for a long, thoughtful moment.
It is something that I can do, he declared.
and drew the stack of papers towards him. Unseelie court fairies did not like too much light. The first thing Sallows, whose name was not really that, had done upon returning to his shop had been to put up wax paper over the window that the Nephilim boy had so heedlessly broken. His spectacles were gone too, lost in the waters of the Limehouse Cut. And no one, it seemed, was going to pay him for the very expensive papers he had ordered for Benedict Lightwood. Altogether, it had been a very bad day. He looked up peevishly as the shop bell tinkled, warning of the opening of the door, and he frowned. He thought he had locked it.
"Back again, Nephilim," he snapped. "Decided to throw me into the river not once but twice. I'll have you know I have powerful friends."
"I don't doubt you do, trickster." The tall hooded figure in the entryway reached around and pulled the door shut behind him. "And I'm very interested in learning more about them." A cold iron blade flashed in the dimness, and the satyr's eyes widened in fear. "I have some questions to ask you," said the man in the doorway. "And I wouldn't try to run if I were you. Not if you want to keep your fingers attached to your body."
Chapter 13. The Mind Has Mountains. Oh, the mind. Mind has mountains. Cliffs of fall frightful. Sheer, no man fathomed. Hold them cheap, may who near hung there. Nor does long our small durance deal with that steep or deep. Here, creep, wretch, under a comfort serves in a whirlwind. All life, death, does end, and each day dies with sleep. Gerard Manley Hopkins. No worst. There is none. Tessa could never remember later if she had screamed as she had fallen. She remembered only a long and silent fall, the river and the rocks hurtling toward her, the sky at her feet. The wind tore at her face and hair as she twisted in the air, and she felt a sharp jerk at her throat. Her hands flew up. Her angel necklace was lifting over her head, as if an enormous hand had reached down out of the sky to remove it. A metallic blur surrounded her. A pair of great wings opening like gates, and something caught at her, arresting her fall. Her eyes widened. It was impossible, unimaginable. But her angel, her clockwork angel, had grown somehow to the size of a living human being, and was hovering over her, its great mechanical wings beating against the wind. She stared up into a blank, beautiful face, the face of a statue made of metal, as expressionless as ever. But the angel had hands as articulate as her own, and they were holding her up as the wings beat and beat and beat, and she fell slowly now, gently, like a puff of dandelion fluff blown on the wind. "Maybe I am dying," Tessa thought, "and this cannot be." But as the angel held her and they drifted together toward the earth, the ground came clearer and clearer into focus. She could see the individual rocks by the side of the stream now, the currents as they ran downstream, the reflection of the sun in the water. The shadow of wings appeared against the earth and grew wider and wider until she was falling into it, falling into the shadow, and she and the angel plunged together to the ground and landed in the soft dirt and scattered rocks at the side of the stream. Tessa gasped as she landed, more from shock than impact, and reached up, as if she could cushion the angel's fall with her body. But it was shrinking already, growing smaller and smaller, its wings folding in on themselves, until it struck the ground by her side, the size of a toy once more. She reached out a shaking hand and seized it. She was lying on uneven rocks, half in, half out of the chilly water. It was already soaking through her skirts. She seized the pendant and crawled up the side of the stream with the remainder of her strength, and collapsed at last on dry ground with the angel pressed against her chest, ticking its familiar beat against her heart. Sophie sat in the armchair by the side of Jem's bed that had always been Will's place, and watched Jem sleep. There had been a time, she thought, when she would have been most grateful for this opportunity, a chance to be so close to him, to place cold cloths against his forehead when he stirred and murmured and burned with fever. And though she no longer loved him as she once had, the way, she realized now, one loves someone one did not know at all, with admiration and distance, It still wrung her heart to see him like this. One of the girls in the town where so